Perkins is an Apollo 11 moon race era rocket scientist who ran supercars at Sebring and Daytona. He taught astronauts to race cars in secret without the approval he knew NASA wouldn't give, drove and sold for pennies on the dollar what is arguably one of the most valuable cars in the world today, and maintains a deep connection to space exploration, automotive engineering, in racing. He worked on the first moon landing, the Viking mission, and the legendary Ferrari 250 GTO. It was an absolute pleasure to sit down with Larry. Happy listening.
Larry, thanks so much for coming on to the show.
I'm happy to be here.
I want to start off with some background here and ask where this story begins. I guess in some ways it began at a surf bar in Florida with you and your buddies. Would you say that's true, or talk me through the early days?
It was a little earlier than that. In 1960, I had gotten hooked up with a chap named Gordon Pennington, who lived in Winter Park, Florida, when I was working in Florida, and he was into racing. He had purchased the first Ferrari 250 GT short wheelbase car at the Paris show in 1959 and took it to Sebring, Florida for a race, which they did pretty well in. And then he invited me to join them in Nassau for the Nassau Speed Weeks. And in the process, I ended up meeting a chap by the name of Count Wolfgang von Trips, better known as Taffy. And Taffy drove for the Ferrari team, but he was at Nassau driving somebody's car, and he took me out in Gordon's Ferrari. And we ran around 10 laps or so, and he kept turning up the wick, so we started going pretty fast. This is in practice. But still, there was a little traffic and things, and I just became entranced with the whole process. I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever done, and I promised him that as soon as I got back to the mainland, I was going to go racing. And he said, that's the best thing you can do in your life. Unfortunately, 10 months later, he was killed at Monza, vying for the world championship. And so I never saw him again after that November. But it all stuck with me. And I did go racing with the Sports Car Club of America. And subsequently got the idea in my head that since we lived an hour and a half away from Daytona, I ought to get a car and go compete in the Daytona 13-hour race, which was the first of its kind that year, 1964. Then I announced that to my buddies, and you read about it in the book. And they all laughed, and we all had a big swig of beer. And there wasn't any way that this amateur guy with this little bitty car and a year of experience was going to get a Ferrari GTO and or run it in a 13-hour race.
Yeah.
But that's what I did. And well, so
what happened next? How did you do it?
I found the only GTO for sale in the world, because by that time, Ferrari had built about 33 or 4 of the 36 that they ultimately produced.
What year is this, Larry? What time?
This was 1964, and the cars began being built in 1962. I did not know that the one I found, which was well used, was the first one ever built. And so the guy in New York named Bob Grossman and I reached a price on this thing of $10,000, and I flew up to New York and paid him. We went into the garage, and there's no car. And by the way, he gave me a handwritten receipt, which is the only paperwork I really ever had on that car. And he said, your mechanic from Long Island has come over here and taken the car. So I assumed that everything was fine. Thank you very much. He took my check. I got in the rental car and went over to Long Island to see my first glimpse of this thing. And there's a picture of it in the book up on jack stands in the corner of the shop with all the guts out lying on the floor. And of course, I almost fainted. Maybe I did faint. And that was the beginning of a first, a three-year stint with the car, doing fairly well for a privateer without a lot of money. And then, as the story developed, the car has been with me in spirit and in fact all these years, even though I sold it and bid it goodbye and thought that's the end of the story, you know. I kept racing for quite a few years, but I didn't run that car anymore because it wasn't competitive. At that level of motor racing, a four-year-old car is pretty much at the end of the game because developments and new technology will take over. And if you're running it, you're just running it for fun and you're going to be at the back of the pack. And so as a consequence, and because of some pretty strong urging from my wife, I got rid of the car. So it was, started out as a whimsical idea, matured very quickly into a search for a car. And then the serious part started, which was a regular trip to the bank, which is what race cars are car. And it's just like a sailboat, which I've also done. It's like dumping money in the water with a sailboat. And with a car, I guess it's just throwing it out the window. But it's, it's an addictive thing that people all admit to, that cars are a hard thing to get out of your system.
Why do you think that is? What is it about racing or going fast? I mean, maybe there's some sort of biological impulse here or grounding.
There is.
What is it about going fast that, that is so appealing? Or why do men race?
I think part of it is the feeling of speed. Some people just like to feel speed. You know, that's why skiers, downhill skiers, enjoy that so much, and other people. But there's also the skill component. To do a sport like motor racing well takes a lot of practice, a lot of dedication, and it's difficult to do at the time. In endurance racing, you add this physiological component. It's stressful. The heat is murderous in a car running 12, 13, 24 hours. And so all of that amounts to an athletic enterprise. And the fascination is in being able to do it well. But people do it that really aren't very skillful, but they enjoy it tremendously and they like the competition. Scott, that's the other thing. You savor the idea of beating somebody head to head, just like you do if you run against them or race bullfrogs against their bullfrog, whatever it is, there's that winner's feeling when you've done it better than the rest of the guys.
Yeah.
But it sticks with you. You know, I'm into cars today. I don't race, obviously. But I'm an active member of the Ferrari Club, for example. I haven't had a Ferrari in 50-some years. But they like it because, you know, I'm the old guy and I have stories to tell and stuff like that. And they've enjoyed that book quite a bit because it touches the hot spots. I think that's the quickest I can tell you that part.
Larry, how did astronauts factor into the mix here? How did NASA and astronauts factor in? What was your involvement with space engineering as well as auto engineering?
I got a job at the Cape with the IBM company in 1961 when there were very few people at the Cape. Most of
Cape
the
Cape Cod you're talking about in off of Massachusetts?
No, Cape Canaveral in Florida.
Not
Cape Cod. The Florida setup for the Atlantic test range was primarily a weapon system testing thing. And then NASA began the project to go to the moon after President Kennedy gave a rousing speech that said, "We're going to go to the moon before 1969. And everybody said, yeah, and, you know, rocks can fly. So so when I got to the Cape, that program was just beginning. It was a very small community of people who worked in the space program at that time. And most people knew each other. And the astronauts were just a bunch of pilots who came from various services. They were all ex-service people. And we got to know each other. And then it developed that a couple of the guys raced boats in Clear Lake where they were stationed in Texas. And they were fascinated with cars and wanted to get a license. And by that time, I had ended up being an instructor in the Sports Car Club of America school, driver school. And some astronauts came to the school. And this was pretty crazy because these were hotshot jet fighter pilots. And they jumped in the cars and just went fast.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And so one thing led to another, and we got to be kind of social friends. And that's how that all happened. Sure enough, a couple of those guys went racing, and they hooked up with an old Indy driver named Rath, and Rathman provided them with cars, and when they were in Florida, they would run under aliases because if NASA found out that their million-dollar men were getting in race cars for fun, that would have been that have been bad news.
Yeah.
So that was kind of how it developed, and it was pretty satisfying to be able to work with guys who went to the moon. And Pete Conrad, whom I knew pretty well, was the third guy to walk on the moon. And almost the first one. But he was kind of a temperamentally, not frivolous, but playful sort of guy. And I think NASA wanted a more serious chap, so Neil Armstrong got that job. I didn't know Neil Armstrong. I guess he didn't like cars.
Yeah.
So that was the era. Very tight community, weapon system testing on the one hand, and going to the moon on the other, coupled in a place where you could launch to the east, taking advantage of the Earth's rotation to give you a little booster boost. And to this day, that range is still where we go from. Polar orbits go out of Vandenberg in California.
Right.
But equatorial orbits leave from the Cape. Except now that Elon Musk is starting to launch from Texas, but he's still going east across the Gulf of Mexico and over Florida and over the Atlantic. So it's kind of simple physics. And now thousands upon thousands of people are involved in these projects. But in the old days, you met Walter Cronkite in the bar, and the next day he was out at the Cape announcing a space mission. And so it was tight. It was fun.
And what was your involvement with the Apollo mission and then the Viking mission? Could you talk a little bit about
those? Yeah, Apollo flew on a rocket launch vehicle booster called a Saturn V, which was a big monster three-stage booster, and it had a brain, sort of, a stage of the rocket at the top called the instrument unit. And the only thing that was in the instrument unit was electronics, and IBM had the contract for the instrument unit. So I was with the IBM office at the Cape, and we did various computer systems projects associated with the instrument unit. So that was my primary involvement with Apollo. And then I left. Nobody in those days ever left the IBM company. It was like they tattooed your serial number on your forehead and you were there forever.
Yeah,
but in fact, I had worked on a previous project with the Martin Marietta Company on a vehicle called the Titan. And some people from Denver came down to the Cape and coerced me over a beer that I should come to Denver and help with the follow-on design of this system on the Titan. And then there was the draw of Colorado, which I loved, and skiing, which I learned to be as nutty about as I did cars. And also the job was fantastic, so I erased the serial number from IBM and moved out to Denver. And about 4 months later, the project I was hired for got canceled, and I was stuck because I had worked for the IBM company, which in those days never laid anybody off, and now I'm at an true aerospace company, and they laid me off without thinking about it.
Yeah.
But I recovered from that with some help, and my first assignment after that was on something called Viking, which was beginning to be defined as a mission to search for life on Mars. Because, of course, for literally centuries, people have thought there has to be life on that planet. And the Viking was the earliest probe to go and test for live organisms. So we built spacecraft, we built test systems and so on, and we flew the thing to Mars in 1976, two spacecraft. They did tests with an onboard laboratory, beautiful little box about as big as a shoebox, that did everything that a lab full of white-coated scientists are supposed to do. And I'll tell you that the results to this day are inconclusive. There were signs that there might be organic organic life at the microscopic level on the surface. Well, since then, we've sent rovers. Now we've got a helicopter, and we've tested all over the planet and found all kinds of interesting things, but no little green men.
And not little green men.
So the Viking program was a fantastic challenge.
Yeah. I mean, that was the first Mars rover, right?
It was, and it was stationary. It was a tripod spacecraft, weighed about 1,300 pounds, and it landed in a spot where the rocket engine, the landing rockets, were made to disperse the blast from the rockets so that the spot that the spacecraft lit on was clean and not damaged in any way by the landing. But it couldn't go anywhere. It had a 6-foot-long scoop that was articulated and could be used to scoop up samples and dump them into this little laboratory. And it had a 3D camera so it could take panoramic pictures and so on. But it couldn't go anywhere. And that drove every scientist to bend all their efforts to start building rovers.
Yeah.
And now the rovers, of course, are very advanced. And that wonderful little chopper that was built to last just a few tests is still flying. It's flown, I don't know, 30 missions or something. And the next wave will undoubtedly have a better helicopter. It's hard to make a helicopter fly in Mars because the air is so thin. So it's a trick to get the thing light enough and get enough spin on the rotors to lift this thing off. But the next one's going to be dandy. You're going to love it because it's going to go all over the place and it'll be wonderful. Mars is a cool place.
Yeah,
you ought to think about signing up for a trip to Mars, Scott.
Well, you know, they have all these space exploration programs. Jeff Bezos, he has the blue something, Elon Musk.
Blue Origin, yeah.
Blue Origin. So do you think, is there potential for us to go and live on Mars with, you know, whatever contraptions, whatever the air pressure and the heat or... First of all, why can't we live on Mars? The atmosphere is not conducive for the...
The atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide, which we don't breathe. And the conditions are very, very cold in the dark and pretty cold when the sun is out. The surface is dry. There's some subterranean water, but the discoveries of water reservoirs or anything of that sort is still lacking. So the living on Mars would require living in a habitat, wearing an extra vehicular suit every time you go outside. And the biggest problem is radiation, sun's radiation on the trip out there, because shielding a spacecraft today with our technology equals weight. And of course, weight is the enemy when you're trying to launch a vehicle to go off the Earth, away from Earth gravity. So there are a lot of challenges to sustaining life in cruise mode to get to Mars, which is 140 million miles away. So it takes several months to get there. And all that time, the occupants of the spacecraft are exposed to solar radiation, mostly gamma rays, or cosmic rays. And once arriving, you've had to take everything with you. And if you ever plan to come back to the Earth, you've got to have the fuel and so forth in a proper vehicle to make the return trip. So I think we're going to have to sign up, that is, we the human race, going to have to sign up for one-way trips to begin. And that takes, you'd say, well, gosh, who's going to do that? There's a waiting list of people who have volunteered to make a one-way trip to Mars. I'd do it in a minute.
But why is that?
Well, because I'm 91 years old. Okay.
No, I mean, it requires some guts. I know what you mean. If you ask a 25-year-old to go to Mars and maybe not make it there, and certainly not make it back, it's a big ask. I'm not a scientist. We obviously have evolved on Earth to live within the conditions that are available to us here on Earth. I think the more generations that progress in Mars, they'll become more and more suited and acclimated to the climate. Perhaps some sort of mutation will allow people to breathe carbon dioxide. Again, I shouldn't even be commenting on this because I really have no idea. I'm the first to admit this is not my area of expertise.
No, but the gurus, the scientific gurus, will all agree with you that we are going to become a spacefaring nation, a world. Some nations on this planet will become spacefaring in everyone's opinion. Just a question of time, technology development, and maybe global warming that might drive us off of our home. And so,
like Interstellar, like the Earth is destroyed, so we need to go live in space.
Yeah. In fact, there are some people who, you know, there's a principle called the Fermi paradox, named after a physicist, Enrico Fermi. The Fermi paradox basically asks the question, where is everybody? They look out with a telescope and see thousands of potential life-supporting planets, both in the solar system and in the universe at large. Nobody comes here. Why don't they? One of the reasons it's postulated is they destroyed themselves. Their technology overran them. And we see these little hints of it now. We see global warming, which everyone is shrugging at and saying, oh, yeah, it's going to get a little hotter. And there are the bots, which are starting to emerge practically at the speed of light since November. And there are the nuclear threat, which is insane, but there it is. And so it's possible to imagine that we'll have to leave. I don't know either. But I do know, I wrote a little story about this, but I don't think it's in our book. Mankind has been looking starward, skyward, dazzled by the things that are there since we came down out of the trees. And man, by his nature, has to see what's over the next hill, what's over the body of water, and subsequently, what's out there. So human curiosity alone drives us to go looking. And we've proven that we will do it and that we can do it. Because we put guys on the moon, and anybody who says we didn't needs to come and talk to me. Because I had a lot of skin in that game.
It's, you know, sometimes I think about what's out there. And then I think to myself, it doesn't really matter for me right now in this moment how I live my life. I mean, obviously, you know, I try to put love into everything I do. I try to be a good, decent person. And I don't, I, when I think to myself that I'll probably die here on planet Earth in this lifetime, it doesn't bother me that much. But there is that spark of curiosity, you know, that you can't bury, of what's out there. And it's just like the world is so infinite. You know, I, in college, I don't know if this is the best example, but I majored in history. I chose to major in history. And at my university, I think maybe there were 30, 35 disciplines in which I could have majored. And you always ask yourself, what if I had studied, you know, biology? What if I had studied French? What if I had studied philosophy? Sure. As opposed to history. Ultimately, I think some of them would have affected the course of my life. If I had gone and pursued a job in investment banking, as many people with whom I went to school did, I think my life would look quite different now. Not in a way that I prefer the life I have now to the life of imagining myself as an investment banker. But I guess what I'm getting at, Larry, is that there's always going to be roads untaken and questions unanswered. And the older I get, the more I realize that there are fewer answers and more questions.
You have to, I believe you're right. I think that you first have to explore some of the forks in the road. And sure enough, those lead to consequences and experiences that you never anticipated. And so it becomes very, very unpredictable. That is your future. But the interesting thing that you just told me about studying history is that you have a realization that the behavior of these creatures with the brains that we call people when we're not calling them nasty names, that have progressed through in the centuries that we have any recorded history. And you can point to almost any path that you've studied and say, hey, that wasn't exactly preordained when that guy was, you know, 15 years old and beginning to think about what he might go into. And then there are the polymaths who put their arm around everything. And some of them have been important. So I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think you know where you're going to go, but I suspect it probably will be on the planet because nobody will give you a ride anywhere else unless, who knows? You might go to Mars as a historian of the human race. You can't tell.
Yeah, remind everybody of what we built, what once was. It's impossible to predict. I was talking to my friend the other day, and he said, anybody who tells you what the world is going to look like in 10 years is lying. I think that's true. I remember 10 years ago. I mean, what is it, 2023 now? You know, we're talking about like early days of, or beginning, I started to use Facebook. This is, you know, before Instagram, TikTok, all this stuff. Before Tesla, I think. I don't know when Tesla was founded, but the world looked different. I think it happens in gradual stages until, you know, but it compounds. The difference compounds. The world that my father grew up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, very different world than
different animal. Yes, that's right. Well, there's 8 billion of us.
Yeah.
50% of us have an IQ above 100 statistically. That's 4 billion pretty damn smart people. And they're living in all kinds of ecological niches and sociological niches and educational surroundings. And the potential for them to do things that we can't even think of right now is 100%. So you're bound to get a surprise at least a year. Every year you'll get a surprise, maybe sometimes every month. I referred to the AI bots a while ago, and we've gotten a surprise from them since November every few weeks. And that, for us sci-fi freaks, presages a kind of a scary future, especially if you spent your life doing computer systems work, which I did, because you recognize what you don't know about these things is greater than what you do. I can't imagine that it won't be fun, though. And so I think you're right. Relax and live your life. Things will happen. And, you know, somebody may hand you a magic wand down the road a ways and you'll do something spectacular with it. So that's great.
Well, like on the subject of living one's life and doing so as joyfully as possible. You noted in one of the dedications to your book, you said, you dedicated it to Scuderia de Berry, and you said, whose people understood the passions that a machine may infuse into people's lives. What did you mean by that? What kind of passion are we talking about here?
Guy called me up one day. He didn't identify himself. He said, I have your car. I said, what car? He said, your old Ferrari. I have your old Ferrari, 3223. And I'm going to restore it, and I'm going to win Pebble Beach with it. But there's no documentation, and everybody is dead. You're the only guy who knows anything about it. Can you help us restore this car? I mean, this fell out of the sky like a shooting star. And the rest of the story is the end of the book, and I'm not going to tell it on your podcast, but I urge everybody to read it. It's a good story. However, good advertising, Scott. But the point I made in that little dedication was that this fellow, who's a collector and owner of that car, although he keeps himself very private, recognized that this was a piece of automotive history. And automotive history is key to a major part of the development of the human race in the 20th and 21st centuries. And he knew that he could press my button and I would jump on an airplane and go wherever he told me to go to help bring this restoration dream to fruition. He understood that I have a personal passion for the car, the machine, but also, more generally, its impact on society. And you can't deny the impact of automotive science and technology on the society throughout the world. Everybody, even a village in Ghana, wants one of these things and at least a motor scooter, but they'd rather have a car. And those are two things that pace some of our lives. So I wasn't trying to be terribly philosophical. I was just sort of thanking them for the opportunity to help them to do this thing without identifying anybody by name, because that's a private matter.
Hmm. Well, and, go ahead.
You first.
I was going to ask him a separate question, but please finish on the subject. It's a private matter.
Yeah, the car collection community is a sort of a closed society in itself. Some people are very open about their holdings. Some of these collections are very large and worth many millions. And this particular car that we keep talking about is the pinnacle of the collector's sort of obsession. It's the holy grail of car, of vintage car collection. And at this point, we can't really predict what the next one will sell for. They almost always sell in private deals. It's difficult to pin down how much money is really exchanged. But we know we're in the tens of millions, the high tens of millions with these cars. But they may be parked, as this one is, in a garage full of these things. Old Ferraris, old Maseratis, old Lamborghinis, Stutz Bearcats, Bugattis, you could just go on and on and on. And so people mostly don't brag about it. They keep it to themselves. And I can conjecture that one of the reasons is that if you are sitting on a garage full of million-dollar or multi-million-dollar cars, you might be vulnerable to harm, let's say. And yeah. So if I had a stack of gold bricks here in the basement, I probably wouldn't tell you about it. So it's just, it's quite an unusual sport that they engage in, because there are cars that are rarer by far than this Ferrari, but they don't have the appeal. And so it ain't the number of carats in the ring in this case. It's something else. It's a mystique. And anybody who's ever driven one of these things is happy to get into the game and say, oh, there's nothing like this. This is a different animal. Even today, this 60-year-old car will go like the wind. And it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
I interrupted you a second ago.
No, I interrupted you. Which I apologize. On the subject of going like the wind, there's a line of thinking that the cars are just like go faster and faster and faster. Obviously, there's this question of what's street legal and not, but I mean, you can modify cars to just, you know, break through whatever restrictions exist. Street racers do it. And the Formula One cars have just gotten faster and faster and faster. I mean, I could see we get to the point, cars probably exist that could drive like upside down in a tunnel. But is there a limit, or will cars just be able to eventually, you know, break through the speed of light or the speed of sound? I don't know. Is there a limit somewhere, or would the cars, theoretically, could the cars just become faster and faster and faster until...
If you put enough money and enough physics into it, you can certainly go 300 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. That's been done lots of times, but those are one-offs.
In what about case, 500 or 600 or 1,000 miles an hour?
That starts to be a real trick because of aerodynamics, just keeping it from taking off. However, that's been done too. If you read the records at the Bonneville Salt Flats for land speed record cars, God bless.
Bless me. thank you.
The land speed record cars with rocket engines will go fast, but you can't do anything except go in a straight line. A Formula One car can be driven. Now, last year, they began to discover something called porpoising, which is an aerodynamic effect in which air gets under the car and raises it. And then the little aerodynamic shockwave passes and the car settles down again and it bounces down the track. So they had to give that feature up and raise the cars a little bit simply to make them drivable. And not torture the drivers, because the drivers' heads and eyes were going, you know, blah, 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 blah. There are limitations to pragmatic designs, but they do go 220 miles an hour on the straight, and I can tell you that is quick, because that old Ferrari would go 190, and you had to pay attention.
Yeah.
And so 220 with a guy sitting, so that's the other thing, to make a concession to aerodynamics. They've been putting the drivers down lower and lower and lower. So now they peek out over the bodywork and peer between the or around the central pillar of a protective thing called a halo, which keeps them from being hurt if they go on their head. And so they're squinting out through these sort of little windows, and they also have face mask over their eyes.
Visor.
And they can hardly see out of those damn cars. So you think about going 220, getting ready to slow down for a corner that is 30 miles an hour, and other cars are around, but you can't really see them because you're down in the bodywork. It's almost too exciting.
there's been a lot of controversy about these halos, Larry. Like, yeah. I mean, some would argue, including me, that Formula One has become much too safe. I preferred the era that Michael Cannell was writing about when more people were dying, the gladiatorial element.
The '50s and sixties.
Yeah, I'm not a sadist, but there's all, you know, you just brought up a great example of the halos. I mean, again, I'm not an expert on this. I don't claim to be an expert on this, but they could drive without the halos. Would that improve visibility?
Yes. If you look at the old Formula One car of the 70s, 80s, the driver sat up pretty high, was master of most of what he could survey. He could see his front wheels and exactly where they went. He could see traffic. He had mirrors that were right here. So when you looked in your mirror, you saw a pretty good representation of what was behind you and next to you. So visibility was pretty good. As the aerodynamics demanded that the airstream become better, made sense to lower the driver and begin to, for instance, put his mirrors out here, where he can't see as much. At the last Formula One race in Saudi Arabia a couple of weeks ago, driver Fernando Alonso was penalized for positioning his car for the start in a box which is painted in white on the grid. He pulled up, I forget what it was, 7 centimeters or something too far to the left. His left front wheel was outside the little painted box. He couldn't see the box. Yeah. So he aimed at the box while he could still see it, you see, and pulled up to where he thought he was positioned in the box. They penalized the guy for being this far outside the box, standing perfectly still. He had no advantage of any kind, and they've changed the rule a little bit now for this next race in Australia. But my point is, Fernando could only see the tops of his front wheels. And long ago, in the era that you like, you sat above the wheels and looked down on them. When you turned the wheel, you could see exactly where it went. And that's a non-subtle difference.
This is all in the name of aerodynamics or safety or a combination of the two? Or
the halo is definitely for safety because it's an aerodynamic challenge in itself at these speeds. However, seating of the driver is basically just to get the car profile as low as you can. The weight close to the ground. So the engines are set very low in the chassis. Driver's butt is very, very low, about that far above the asphalt. And the whole thing is designed to pierce the air and glue it to the ground with downforce. It's a trade-off, and the aerodynamicists are the heroes these days. And there's one who seems to be better at it than anybody else. His name is Adrian Newey. He's a Brit who designs the aerodynamics for the Red Bull car. And nobody seems to be able to quite penetrate Adrian Newey's secrets. But if he didn't have the driver, he could probably make the car aerodynamically even better. Enter the bots. Yeah. You're going to live to see bots driving race cars, I promise you.
I'm sure we could do it already. We have drones. I mean,
sure, you know, yeah, exactly.
There's the remote control cars, but I don't want that. I mean, we opened this conversation talking about why men like the race. Men like to watch other people race as well.
That's right.
I don't want to see robots race. I don't care who has the best engineering. I mean, look, a lot of Formula One today is engineering. I think it's gotten away from, you know, I'm torn here because on the one hand, it would be interesting to see if we give 10 guys the same car. They all have Honda Civics with the same engine and the same amount of fuel, you know, and the same gearbox. Who's the best driver? Like, just same machine. The only different variable is drivers. But at the same time, you can't differentiate the two. Drivers do all kinds of tinkering around with their cars and their teams to make it better. So maybe if everyone started with baseline the same. But now in Formula One, you know, who has more investment? Which company has more money? Ferrari was one of the wealthiest teams. McLaren was one of the wealthiest teams in the 70s. Now Mercedes just, it seems like the wealthiest, though I've stopped following Formula One. Not out of any objection. I've just been busy. but there's this question of, are we watching the racers drive or are we watching the cars drive? You know, are we yes. watching the men race or are we watching the machines race?
Yes, you're right. And if you look at NASCAR, they attempt to do what you're talking about. They have a single car. Formula Ford, Formula V, Indy cars, they all adhere to an old sailboat competition principle called one design. Way back when, in the early days of the 20th century, people used to race little sailboats that were identical. I mean, right down to the fabric in the sails. And that was meant to promote competition with the sailors' skill. And that seemed to work pretty well, and it does pretty well today. So when you put 30 or 40 NASCAR cars on the track, you sort of don't know who's going to win that thing because they have such similar cars. They only vary on the details and the crew. So you're still racing against the crew skills because the crew can do a few things. But you're right about the old days. There are many people who prefer to see the guy driving the car and see what he does that somebody else doesn't. And so the fans get a certain window into the sport. If you were inside this sport, you'd have a little different view. But those considerations are the same. Everybody struggles with it. And everybody knows that the real winner is cubic dollars, not cubic inches.
Larry, why did you write this book?
It's a Petra's idea originally. She had a book started called A Racy Life. And it was not quite so thoroughly thought out yet. But we had conversations with people over the years about all these stories. And our particular life story, because as I think you learned before, Petra was a car hater. She raised little boys and they played with cars and it drove her nuts. So she was not a car fan. But then she began to like sports cars and one thing led to another. And then she married me and found out, after quite a while, by the way, that I used to race. And people said, why don't you write these stories down? This is quite a development. So we did. But then we got serious about it. We wanted to write a book that was that had some fun in it and some meaning. The other thing is that phone call I told you about. I got that phone call in the fall of 2010. And up to then, I had forgotten about my particular old cars. One of them is in New Zealand, and this one is in the United States. And other than that, I didn't even know this one had come back from Japan, to be frank about it. So that was kind of a trigger. Hey, this is an additional adventure that sort of closes a loop. And that's where Racy Life became full circle. And it became a memoir instead of a racing book. One other point. Very few of the people who have actually raced write. David Hobbs has written a nice book called Hobbo. Sam Posey has written a book. I can't remember the title of it. Out of the hundreds of the thousands of people who have raced at particularly the higher level, they don't write. They don't even brag. They're just nice, self-effacing guys who happen to get that thrill we were talking about. So it seemed like it would be a fun thing to do. And then Petra submitted this to some publishers. Would you like to publish this book? And they said, we like it. It's a nice story, but we don't think we can make any money. So bye-bye. Also, it would take 3 years minimum to get a book published. So we looked into self-publishing, and one thing led to another, and you're holding the result.
Very nice result. Yeah.
It's a pretty interesting thing, isn't it? We made the cover so that you can throw that thing in the trunk of your car with your golf clubs or whatever.
Yeah.
And it won't get all torn up.
Nice and thick.
Yeah. Durable. You could dribble some grease and oil on it if you want to, and it'll wipe off. We didn't put a dust cover on it because dust covers get lost. And the cover under the dust cover usually is a blank piece of fabric. Mm. So we thought, nah, that's not our kind of book. We want to make one that's like a rock. You can kick it, you can do whatever, and it'll be okay. But it's...
All right, Larry, I got to ask you a question. How much did you sell the car for, and how much is it worth today? And how do you feel about that?
This is literally true. The car got crunched at Sebring in 1966. My dear friend and co-driver, Jack Slotag, drove it up on the sandbank and mashed it up a little bit. But enough so we couldn't keep going. So we put it on the trailer, took it back to the garage in West Palm Beach. They banged it out and patched the paint. And everything else didn't need any work because the car had just a few hours on it. And they said, that'll be $3,600, please. And I said, okay. Hold it. I'll go get the $3,600. In the meantime, some other things happened. I'll cut that out. I found a guy in New York who would would buy it from me for $3,600. And then I could pay the garage for the damage because my friend Jack didn't have any money. He paid me later, but that's another story. Meanwhile, a kid from New Jersey who was working at the garage in West Palm agreed to drive it up Route 1 from Florida to New York over the road with a dealer plate on it. And that happened. And chapter 11 in that book is Spike's story about doing that. So I got paid the $3,600 and I paid German Motors. $3,600 in 1966 would be about $20,000 today. So it wasn't peanuts. And everyone laughs and says, $3,600? You can buy a couple of meals with that. But that's not true. I had bought it for $10,000, which is about $85,000 now. I don't know. I have to look at the inflation tables. But anyway, $3,600, not a lot of money. Car went away. I lost sight of it. And the next time I saw a GTO was in an ad. No, it was a report on an auction. The feds had confiscated one of these cars from a drug dealer. And they had turned it over at auction for around $85,000 in then year dollars.
What year was this?
That would have been around somewhere around 1970. Somewhere in there, a dentist in Minneapolis got hold of the car. He kept it for 20 years. And he cut on it, he chopped on it, he changed stuff. He ran it in vintage races. He drove it on the road and then sold it to a guy in Japan for, I believe, $4 million. The Japanese collector kept it for 10 years. So it came back to the U.S. in 2004 for, I believe, $10 million. But that was about the time when these cars began to really escalate in collector value, collectors' willingness to pay these high prices. The next installment is another one of the GTOs was sold at auction for $48 million. And then I believe about 4 years ago, Dave McNeil, who owns the WeatherTech company, you may know WeatherTech, it's a car accessory outfit, he bought one of the later cars for $80 million. My car, this car, is the first one and the last one running in international competition. I won the trophy first in class at Daytona in the 24-hour race, the first 24-hour race there, in 1966. So the car has an interesting history and I think it's worth $100 million.
A couple dollars more than $3,600.
Now, how do I feel about it? Well, the day that car left on the trailer to go to the garage and get the last touch up before Spike hit the road with it, my wife and I stood in the driveway with martinis and we drank a toast and said, bye-bye, Sophia. It was nice knowing you, honey. And that's how we felt then. We got a divorce. And later on, when the newspaper article came out about the 85K, I clipped it and sent it to her. And then after that, just, you know, it sort of didn't matter. The numbers kept going up, and I thought, this is just crazy. These are old wore-out race cars.
Yeah.
You have no idea how uncomfortable it is to drive one for more than 15 minutes on the road. You know, it's not a grocery getter.
Yeah.
And but it has this mystique, and that's what drives the price up. Well, 3223, this car is perfectly restored down to the rivets. To the condition on February 14th, 1966, when we started in the 24 hours of Daytona. It is a perfect restoration. It's got all correct parts. Everything in it might just as well have come out of the factory. It's pristine. Gotta be worth a lot of money. I probably won't get any of that. But I've had a good relationship with the owners, and so that's okay. We're friends, and we kind of scratched each other's back there for, you know, a few months, and it's okay. He's a very enthusiastic supporter of the book, and is tickled that it tells the story the way it does. No punches pulled. And he drives it. He takes it to a private racetrack and rings it out every once in a while. So it's running. It's not a garage queen. And the parts that I've written in there about actually driving that thing, he can corroborate. That's what it is. And that's the story. So the big bucks eluded me, but I would have never kept it, you see. Joy wouldn't have let me keep it.
Yeah.
She said, it's time to dump this thing. It's had too much effect on our lives and our bank account. And besides, it was very hard to run two race cars and have a day job. Think about it.
Yeah.
So there was something to be said for getting rid of that thing at a penny a pound if necessary. And everybody said, oh, well, that's okay. It's just a worn out old car. It's 4 years old. A four-year-old race car is just a lump. It's just bleeding oil on the garage floor.
Well, Larry, that wraps up my questions. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about? I know we covered a lot of subjects. Or do you feel good about the discussion?
What are you going to do next? You're a busy guy. What's your next
That's
big
an excellent
project?
Question. My next big project, I'm launching a media company called 27 Rouge, underneath of which this podcast is one vertical. I'm launching a magazine, which is another vertical. And then I'm going to be doing lots of short form video content. So lots of stuff on Instagram, TikTok, and the like.
The magazine's going to be an e-magazine?
It's going to be an e-magazine, yes. It'll probably be distributed through Substack, so it'll go straight to people's inboxes, and it'll be focused around a lot of the same things that this podcast is focused on, sort of the arts writ large, cultural commentary from a diverse set of contributors around the world, including myself.
That's pretty exciting.
It is.
It's going to be hard to get enough sleep.
It is going to be hard to get enough sleep. As Warren Zevon said, you can sleep when you're dead. meanwhile, I really like to travel. I don't have a home base anywhere. So I'm going to be doing this from the road. But I'm excited for the next steps.
That's terrific. The very best of luck to you with that enterprise, because that does it all. That keeps you hopping. It keeps the wheels rolling, which is important. You know, we are constantly, and I mean constantly, amazed here at the people we know who are sharp, in some cases pretty imaginative, and they don't do anything. And
why do you think that is?
I don't think they've understood that you can sleep when you're dead. They've already started napping. I don't know the answer to your question, because when you talk to people in that particular niche, they seem to feel...
The nappers? The people who, with all the good ideas, who don't do anything?
Yeah, I think when you talk to them, you don't want to probe them too much because you don't want to make them feel uncomfortable, but you kind of explore a little bit. What are you doing next? And so on. They seem to reach a point where they think they are busy. But it's not the kind of intellectual life that I, for one, have always thought is what keeps you going. I had a dear friend, who was my first college roommate, actually, a guy named Rudy Heitler that lived in St. Petersburg. He died a couple of weeks ago.
Sorry to hear that.
Rudy was still playing tennis a year ago. That was great. But the thing about him was, he was interested in everything. And you could introduce any kind of topic, and Rudy was right there on top of it. So he didn't just play tennis to keep his blood flowing. The blood was flowing up here all the time. I thought he was my hero. And I was sure sorry to see him go, but he ran out of steam finally. But he's an aberration that most of the people I know at a certain point send emails to each other about how terrible it is to have backaches and, you know, one bad eye and their hair is falling out, so forth and so on. You worry about that when you're dead, right? So I admire your idea of doing an enterprise like that.
Keep me posted. I will. I'll make a note. Gonna add you to my distribution list.
Okay. Maybe I can send you some business.
Go ahead, sure. You know, I have another idea for why all the bright people aren't doing things. There's that old quote that I think it was Charles Bukowski. He said, "The problem with the world is that the dumb people are full of confidence and the smart people are full of doubt." There's that element to it. But another is this parable. I've talked about this before on the podcast, of a sheep. And this sheep, you know, he's presented with 100 barrels of hay. And he can, you know, he can have his pick of any of these fucking barrels of hay. He can have any barrel he wants. But the sheep, not knowing which barrel to start with, starves to death. All he had to do was just pick one barrel and start eating the hay. But instead, he dies of starvation. I think that characterizes some of the people that you're describing in Florida. It's characterized me at certain parts of my life where we live in an era of almost infinite choice. You can travel anywhere in the world. You have the knowledge of most of human history at your fingertips, the smartphone. We can do anything, I think, but I think because we can do anything, sometimes we do nothing.
There's something we've been talking about lately that I think is pertinent to your remark. And that is, we have a particular friend who seems to have no sense of self-determination, really, and a feeble self-confidence. It's a lacking of self-confidence, a feeling of independence. If presented with the 100 barrels of hay, I'm afraid she would starve. Because for whatever reason, she's unwilling or unable to go and say, the hell with it, I'm just going to eat this barrel and see what happens. Maybe I'll get a stomachache. But then maybe there's something in that hay that I don't know about that's going to lead me to something else. So it's an attitude, isn't it? I mean, it's a kind of a thing that may stem from upbringing. I think that when you're very small and you start soaking up the world and you're inarticulate, but you got your eyes going and your ears, and you begin to absorb what's happening. And if something or somebody begins to defeat you, you stop listening, you stop watching, and you lose that urge to just do something. Maybe we aren't all built that way. I just don't know. I only have myself and a couple of close friends to judge from. But your remark about the world being, you used to say, the world is our oyster. Well, it certainly is now, because you have access to everything if you want to. Think of the number of people that you've probably met who won't listen to the news. Makes them nervous. They don't want to hear bad things. And news by definition is the bad stuff. Happy news doesn't sell, right?
Yeah.
But it helps to know what the rest of the world's mental processes are if you pay attention. If that makes you too nervous, I don't know, you ought to go live on the top of a mountain and pick berries.
And some people do that, and they like it.
I know, and they're happy, and they're wasting a very valuable resource because you only get one. I don't care what anybody thinks about reincarnation and all that kind of. I know you get one shot, and some people have their shot abbreviated, which is tragic. But if you're around, the world's your oyster. So
absolutely.
It's anyway, I didn't mean to bend your ear too much about that. I'm not much of a philosopher.
No, I liked. Well, bring it out in us.
I never expected to be here at 91 anyway. I faced my mortality a long time ago, but Petra made me stop drinking. That helped. And because I did a lot of that. I was really good at that and really bad. And I've had three careers, you know, so what the hell? And it's take every chance you get, long as it won't cut your head off. But do not jump off of a cliff with a flying suit. That's the wrong thing to do.
Shane McConkey did that. And that was a real, real shame. It was a wonderful, wonderful skier. It's exactly what he did on skis. And then he never came down. He never came back again.
Why did they do that?
He was a great... He was one of the great skiers of the world. There's a documentary about him called McConkey. And he would go off cliffs with the squirrel suits on skis and, you know, do all kinds of aerial maneuvers. And he was one of the best in the world. And it worked hundreds of times right up until the one time that it didn't.
Right.
But, yeah, no, that's not on my immediate to-do list.
You're going to travel, but not by squirrel suit.
Not by squirrel suit. No, no. Maybe by Ferrari 250 GTO.
Hey, that'd be good.
That would be a good, but not comfortable for grocery getting, but for everything else. Anyway, Larry, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Enjoyed it very much. It's intriguing.